Hello, welcome to TCJ Talkies, which is the internet's only podcast hosted by me, Mike Dawson, paid for by the Comics Journal. You can follow me and my work at MikeDawsonComics.com, and I'm on Twitter, Mike_Dawes. This is the podcast where cartoonists come on to chat about other people's comics, like a book club. And this is going to be a fun episode. I've got Bill Cartolopoulos and Austin English joining me in the talkie hut to chat about Superboy issue 104, which was published in April 1963 and had drawings by Kurt Swan. We're going to talk about Daniel Clow's new graphic novel Patience, which I haven't read yet, but that is okay, and the new translation of Peplum by Blitch, which was published by New York Review of Books' new graphic novel imprint. And these books were all picked by Austin and Bill, and they actually all do make sense. Austin English is a cartoonist and publisher. His new book, Gulag Casual, is coming out from 2D Cloud. And Austin is also a publisher himself. He runs Domino Books, and he's put out work by Victor Cairo, Inez Estrada, and other cartoonists. Bill Cartolopoulos is a Brooklyn-based comics critic, educator, curator, and editor, and the series editor for the Best American Comics series, which comes out every year from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. He also teaches comics history in the MFA Visual Narrative Program at SVA. So let's get into the conversation.
You guys chose these books, and how did you guys read this Superboy comic?
I've been buying Silver Age Superman family stuff, just really casually. I've just been picking it up whenever I see something cheaply, or just, you know, if I see something around. Partly because it's an era of comics that I've never really read before, and I don't know how I slipped into it, but you know, it partly relates to Dan Clowes, and that for, you know, ever since I've been for maybe a decade of reading interviews with Clowes, he always mentions how much Kurt Swan and Wayne Boring are important to him. And it had been something I always kind of filed away, that I know those are the style that those artists work in, but I had never actually sat down and read their work. And then once I started doing it, I think I found a that's how it started. I got a really cheap used copy of the Superman Showcase, you know, the Showcase books that DC were putting out maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
So these are like reprints of Silver Age stuff.
Yeah, they're like the Marvel's Essentials. The Showcases are just these gigantic, like, telephone type books with, like, you know, 500 pages for like $10. And I just started reading those, and I just got so you know, I've always, you know, 60s era comics, I've read, you know, Ditko and Kirby stuff from Marvel, but I'd never read that era of DC, and I just got really, really into it. And that the particular Superboy that we're discussing was just there was something about that one that was just so complete and cool, and just I just really got into it, and I thought it would be a fun thing to talk about.
Yeah, because I have to say, like, I also have almost never read – I've read almost nothing of this work or this stuff from this time, and this was really funny, I thought. And like, it really felt like a full story, like it was satisfying.
Yeah.
Like, which I wasn't expecting it to be. Like I completely didn't know what, like, it was much more pleasant than I thought it was going to be to read.
Yeah, it's really crazy, right? Because it's like, it's two different artists. It's George Papp and Kurt Swan. You know, George Papp does the first part, and then Kurt Swan draws the second part.
Where do they split up? Because it's not really labeled that well.
It's, you know,
it
when
part
it's
one and part two?
When it's Kal-El fighting with Grammo, it's you know, pretty sophisticated comic, Grammo. That's George Papp. And then when, you know, you've got the first panel with the British boy who KO's Superboy, that's when Kurt Swan draws it. There's a break in between. I guess what I've been so into with these comics is that, again, with the comparison to 60s era Marvel, which is I think what we're more you know, when we get into comics, even if, you know, we weren't reading comics in the 60s, that's the style that we're more familiar with from that time, that kind of more like loose, freewheeling, you know, Marvel bullpen style. And I got to say, when I started reading these Mort Weisinger era DC comics, I really just was impressed by just how expertly put together. I mean, there are obviously unintended campy elements in these comics, and that's what we think of when we, you know, see these covers and there's a British boy punching Superboy in the face, and you know, it seems really silly. But I guess now what I respond to maybe more than I would have if I had just looked at these when I was a little kid is just like the level of craft and how tightly edited these comics are. Just like there's something so impressive about it, and like you said, satisfying, because it's just like, yeah, there's two different stories here, and then they just they sync together, and it's just you know, it's there's something really impressive about it. And kind of like, especially looking at maybe mainstream comics that come out now, I was just thinking how like DC at this point just knew how to make a coherent, airtight comic, and there's something really cool about it.
What, Mr. K? What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I am. You know, I'm actually only reading this because Austin recommended it, but I'm glad that I had a chance to.
You're angrily reading it.
No.
Austin said you had to.
No, I'm reading it. I read it with great delight and pleasure. It is interesting because I think there's something about this era of DC Comics that's pretty much overlooked, because the sort of mainline historiography of comics history is that, well, in the 60s, DC was boring and then Marvel came along.
Yeah.
So all of the fan scholarship and attention is pretty, not entirely, but I think often has been on, you know, the things that were fresh and unusual about Marvel Comics in the early 60s. When you look at these late 50s, early 60s DC comics, like Austin was saying, there's a real high level of craft there. It's like, you know, especially if you've read superhero comics from the 1940s, which have, you know, a certain kind of vitality, but also can have a kind of slapdash quality.
Or an outsider art quality.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and you know, when you look at that stuff, it's very clear that, like, okay, everyone, I mean, in large part, if you look at comics from the 30s through, like, maybe the 60s, there's one big strand of it anyway is essentially people trying to infuse as much realism into a very small amount of space on a deadline while also keeping it moving, keeping the figures lively, keeping the narrative momentum going. And at a certain point, the peak of that is like Milton Caniff, and everyone is really impressed by how he's mastered this kind of brushy chiaroscuro style of kind of loose but realistic, convincing drawing within the constraints and parameters of the daily comic strip format. And certainly when you look at like a lot of the Golden Age comics from the 40s, it is a almost, you know, often you see something that looks like a kind of simplified, not as skilled take on the Milton Caniff approach.
Okay.
You get to the stuff like this Superboy comic, you know, the kind of Swan or Anderson or is it Kurt Swan?
Kurt
Swan.
Although it looks to me a lot like Wayne Boren. I'm not steeped enough to be able to tell it apart instantly.
Yeah, it does kind of seem like a certain sort of peak of maybe an alternate approach that's like more outline based and illustrative. Less moody, more about, you know, kind of clarity and full figures instead of tight croppings and things like that. I mean, these are just kind of some abstract aesthetic considerations, but there's definitely like a high level of craft there. There is a sort of kind of chilliness or flatness or something to it. Like Austin was saying, I think for me, a big part of the appeal of this too was, sort of having a little bit more, engagement with the things that I know, some artists, including particularly Dan Clowes, have gotten out of this work.
Yeah.
And you can sort of see how there's something about the kind of staticness of it, but the sort of weird, icy sometimes, or sort of muted emotional tone that creates, that an artist might try and evoke more specifically or more consciously, maybe, than the artists working on these comics did.
Well, it's the emotional iciness is, like, I think partly what's so appealing about it to me is that because it's drained of any, you know, the quality that Fantastic Four has when, you know, Ben Grimm is, like, sad about something and it's referencing, or in a lot of people's eyes, succeeding at, like, referencing actual human emotions.
Yeah.
I think what's better about this is when all the logic of, like, the actual world is drained from these Superboy stories, it's almost like it's better because it's just, like, this pure, like, you can just enter this comic and it doesn't have this, like, grasp at the real world. Like, the real world just, like, melts away. It's just these concepts and these characters, so it's a pure, like, you know, if a comic references pop culture and kind of doesn't just, like, makes a stab at referencing it, there's this kind of, like, aesthetic flaw to it, whereas these Superboy comics are just, like, and these DC comics from this era, they have no reference to the real world or any real emotions, and when you get into it, it's just the concepts, and it's like entering into a completely created world in these 22 pages. And I think that way it's like a completely – just this Superboy comic is just a pure object that you can just get into and totally forget about anything else. And you can kind of just get into the expert storytelling that's being done in it. And it's just so filled with – you know, we were talking about it in connection to Patients, and – Klaus is so influenced by this stuff, but there are so, like, Patience has a couple of sci-fi concepts in it, but this, you know, in this small comic, it's just overloaded with, like, every page is like a mini sci-fi epic on its own. So
yeah, I was thinking that there's like a 9-panel sequence where, like, it just moves from, like in the story, Jor-El, the first half of the story takes place on Krypton. And Jor-El is in, like, a science competition with this guy called Grammo, who's actually, like, a super, like, the leader of a Kryptonian crime syndicate.
Yes.
And but he's undercover. He's presenting himself as a scientist to the Kryptonian people, and they basically, like, in the contest, they present their science. And Jor-El has created the Phantom Zone, right?
Yes.
And what is it? Grammo has created is, like, these like alien
android. It's, yeah, like alien-looking androids that, yeah, will, like, do everything.
Yeah, they're like androids that would, like, to replace the robots. That,
right,
the,
and when they're in competition, Jor-El's Phantom Zone presentation melts the android, yeah, or gets it all confused. It makes it melt away.
Yeah, it gets all blubbery and wobbly-looking. And then so Grammo loses, and then on, like, page 10 to 11, it zips through, like, the Kryptonians all vote, Jor-El wins, Grammo, like, vows revenge, there's a Kryptonian robot police uprising, and Jor-El, like, puts it back down with, like, his weather balloon, and, like, it just happens, like, in, like, yeah, 8 panels.
And even when they vote for the two concepts, this is how they vote for it. People of Krypton, if you vote for Jor-El, activate your vote-o-meter so that a blue circle is projected.
Yeah.
I think Grammo's invention is superior, project a red square. So even that is, like, I mean, that's a, yeah, pretty weak concept on its own. But, I mean, in the context of everything else that's happening, it's not even just like a, you know, straight vote, you know?
Yeah, well, then it's just drawn in one panel with this real visual shorthand where it's just like there's, you know, countless little people and then all these – the sky filling up with, you know, blue circles and red squares. And even though it's just – it's drawn very efficiently in one image. I can imagine, especially if you're a kid reading it, excuse me, and you imagine that that's, you know, the Kryptonian voting process, you can sort of imagine a sky just kind of full of glowing shapes. And I think there's a lot because they pack in so many ideas but then treat them so efficiently, there's a lot of room for a reader to flesh them out and kind of imagine them sometimes even on a grander scale than they exist within the comic. And I think
exactly.
You see a lot of that in the work of not just Klaus, but even, you know, people, novelists like Jonathan Lethem and others who have kind of, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, as we used to, you know, reading the same comics over and over again and finding those little kind of ellipses or grace notes or suggestions that your mind can inhabit and sort of flesh out bigger concepts that you could really latch onto.
And that, I mean, these comics were being made at a time when they were actively making them for children and children were reading them. And I think it's so imaginative. And like you say, there's so much in it where if you're a younger reader, you can look at this panel and so much more can happen in your mind. I just think that the editing in these comics is really beautifully done because the storytelling is so clear, but it's so rich with ideas. And that's like this really great synthesis that I don't think, you know, comics for kids now are much more simplified. And I think these were comics that went on to, with Lethem and Klaus, they entered into their brain. They were able to process it and enjoy it as kids. But the higher sci-fi concepts that are embedded in there were able to kind of ingest in their brains. And I think that's really, I mean, I, again, with the comparison to Marvel stuff happening at around the same time, we talk so much about Kirby's concepts and those, he has incredible sci-fi concepts too, but there's something about these that are, I think, really underrated and maybe as beautiful.
Well, I guess what made me think a little bit is you guys said that you're kind of right in that, like, probably people are roughly around our age were always sort of told to kind of like consider the Marvel stuff of the 60s superior, but it was always because Marvel was the one that made it so you could relate to the character.
Right.
Like, you're going to like this better because your family's like the Fantastic Four, and they argue, and like, and you're like Spider-Man. And this is like, that's what this is not like, but it's...
Right.
But like, I'm the same as you, where I've just been told to just disregard this stuff until, you know, so I've never read it.
The Phantom Zone. This is very similar to my biography.
What's that?
No, I was just kidding. I said my dad invented the Phantom Zone.
Okay. There's a kind of a funny sequence on the next page, 12 and 13, when you're talking about, like, the editing. And I don't know if it's, like, inadvertently funny. But what happens in the story, Jor-El has won, you know, he defeats Grammo and his supervillains. And this is essentially the plot of Superman 2, the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This whole comic is, like, basically...
I stumbled upon this one, this issue I just stumbled upon randomly, and it felt like it felt like Superman 2. So I think they must reference the Phantom Zone a lot in this era, but this one feels like an important one.
Yeah,
anyway,
it's basically almost like, yeah, it's like a proto Superman 2. Like, it's not Zod, it's this guy Grammo, but it's the same thing where they get sent away and then they find themselves on Earth later in the story, and like Superboy has to stop them, and they're three superpowered people like him. But I just thought it was a funny like sequence of panels where like Grammo and his henchmen get put into suspended animation. They don't go into the Phantom Zone. They get sent to spaceships to circle Krypton forever.
Right.
But then it just... So they go up into space, and then it just skips to the next panel. They go, months later, there are some villains in the Phantom Zone, and then they introduce three villains who are just who you haven't seen up until now, who are in the Phantom Zone. And then the next panel, it's all of a sudden Jor-El has Scarlet Fever, and the villains in the Phantom Zone, now there's like, you know, a lot of them, there's, you know, a big crowd of them, and they're hypnotizing him to take over his brain while he's in a weakened state. And then the next panel, he's about to release them. He says, "Well, Jor-El, you'll release us from the Phantom Zone." He's like, "I must obey." And Lara, his wife, yells, "Stop." And then the next panel says, "Later, when he's recovered."
Yeah.
Just like, let's just keep moving through this story.
Right. And when the voices are commanding him, he's thinking, voices commanding me, must obey them, release criminals. It's, you know, pretty boiled down to, you know, no personality.
Well, there's a lot of plot mechanics happening here. I mean, sometimes it just seems like one thing after another happening in these comics, but in a weird way, it's all very thoroughly worked out. Like, first of all, they need to be able to establish that criminals in the Phantom Zone can, if they take, you know, certain measures under the right circumstances, communicate with people outside of the Phantom Zone.
Yeah.
Because later in the comic, the villains in the Phantom Zone are going to communicate with Grammo to tell them, like, oh, you don't know about kryptonite, you don't know about this stuff, you don't know about that stuff. We've been observing Superboy for years. Here's some useful information. The other thing they need to establish is Jor-El invented the Phantom Zone, but somehow it needs to get off Krypton before Krypton is destroyed, because Superboy will eventually find it later, because he uses it on Earth. So all of this stuff is just it doesn't all necessarily like hold up to adult rational investigation if you want to like assess it as like a good plot or something, but it's all very worked out. Like, for all the stuff that's crammed in here, there's very little that's extraneous. It's like a perfectly worked out puzzle.
The writing doesn't showboat at all. I mean, it's impressive writing because of all the concepts it's managing, and it's explaining it to you without hindering you too much. But there's no moment where the writer calls attention to his own style. And to me, I wish that was a quality that more mainstream comics writing had, because – the story is airtight enough, and there's no little blurbs of like little catchphrases or anything like how you see in Stan Lee, that you're able to just go – you're whipped through the narrative of the comic, and you get to really experience the art, which I always feel is the best part of mainstream comics anyway. You're able to experience the art without anything bogging you down, and you're just able to get into the concepts happening. So – I don't know. I do think this style of writing for mainstream comics is definitely not didn't win out in the end, but there's something really potent about it.
So you guys have both read Patience, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I haven't read it yet because it's not out in like regular stores yet, right? Or is it just kind of emerging?
I think it's in comic stores. Is that the deal? Like, it hit comic book stores first?
I think it's out. I saw it both at The Strand and at Forbidden Planet yesterday, or last week, whichever, recently.
Well, we don't have to talk about it much, but...
Well, I was going to ask, like, so, well, go ahead with your points, yeah.
We had an idea that maybe we should bring it in just because we happened to be reading it last week, and one of the things about the Superboy comic is, like, I mean, like Austin was saying before, we're both sort of intellectually aware that, you know, Klaus's stuff sometimes has something to do with this type of like early 60s DC comic. You know, like when he talked about in one interview the development of his style, he talked about trying to get this very kind of professional, cold, you know, almost dead line and trying to get to that point. And you know, that's something that's certainly more what you would associate with the DC comics of the 60s than with the Marvel comics, you know, which you know, tend to have a more of a kind of liveliness to them. You know, maybe willing to risk being a little sloppy still in the service of a kind of exuberant dynamism.
I mean, these characters, like, I'm looking at some of the, like, the way the bodies move, it's like they look like action figures. They're all, like, their waists don't bend, the arms are very sort of by their sides, and...
They look like stickers.
Okay, yeah.
Like, the stickers were, it's like it's a comic that's collaged with stickers very, very, very well, you know? Like, no, the stickers aren't obscuring another one. But they could exist on their own, you know? They could exist in your strip of decals without interacting. I mean, all the characters are interacting, but barely, you know?
And I was really struck, especially by the first page of the Superboy comic, because it was so, where, you know, you have the splash page that's sort of signaling a moment that happens later where Jor-El accidentally goes into the Phantom Zone and he can't communicate with his wife and with little Kal-El, Superboy, that, hey, I'm stuck in the Phantom Zone. You have to, you know, fix the machine to get me out. And it just, as soon as I read that, I remembered, as soon as I looked at that page, really, it just immediately made me think of David Boring and the comics that David Boring's father, the character David Boring's father has produced that are in David Boring by Dan Clowes. So the Yellow Streak pages, like we have, you know, essentially something that looks more like an early 60s DC comic than a Marvel comic, the Yellow Streak, you know, drawn in Dan Clowes's sort of evocation of a sort of Silver Age comic book style, and just these disconnected panels that are scattered throughout David Boring, where the main character, the main superhero character in the Yellow Streak is sucked into the Phantom Zone, or the equivalent of the Phantom Zone. And it's exactly like that image of Jor-El, where we see the character sort of invisible and floating and saying, oh no, he can't hear me, he can't see me, and I'm trapped, and all this kind of stuff. And it, you know, just seeing that that image in the Superboy book really felt like we were very directly accessing source material for Dan Clowes. I mean, it almost felt like he maybe had that issue, although there's probably like 10 issues where that happens or something.
But, well, and there's in Patience, and I, you know, should I say spoilers?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Spoiler alerts are for dummies.
Well, I want to keep everybody happy.
Yeah. It's a book club podcast.
There's this thing that happens in Patience where the character goes back in time to correct something that happens with his wife. She's murdered in the beginning of the book, and the plot of Patience is the character journeying back in time to correct things, to see what happens, gather information. Actually, what he ends up doing, he instead of going to the moment when the crime happens, he goes back to when she's younger, and it's kind of this beautiful concept where he's observing her before he knew her, before he met his wife. And he's not supposed to get involved, so he's behind a door watching things happening. And it's you know, he wants to cry out to her when something bad is being done to her, and he actually does come out and end up interfering with events. But it's almost like when he's observing his wife in the past, in the present moment, it's almost the same feeling you have with Jor-El in the Phantom Zone, looking at his wife and child, yeah, and screaming out to them to bring him back. And it's it's like, and this is just a random random Mort Weisinger era comic, and it has so many parallels to Dan Clowes' work. You know, there's that story that I've read that Dan Clowes talks about, that his brother was older, and his brother moved out of a room that Dan, when he was a little kid, moved into, and there were stacks and stacks of his brother's comics that, without seeking them out, Clowes just ended up reading. And I can only imagine how many of these Kurt Swan, Wayne Boring, Mort Weisinger era comics he read. And it's – I guess it's just a weird thing that we've – you know, there's so much writing about Clowes, and I would like – you know, there was an article up on TCJ a few days ago about the Superman artist that I really want to read. But it would be interesting to see someone go – maybe it's been done, I just haven't seen it – to see someone go in and identify, like, just the – how rich the connection between Clowes and these artists are, because it's really beautiful to read them in concert with each other. They build off of each other, and you know, Clowes is obviously much more explicitly emotional and engaging things that you actually experience in your life with these concepts. But I don't know, it makes you appreciate the human things that are happening in the Superboy comic too, even though they're completely drained of any actual feeling. It kind of they accentuate each other in interesting ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think those comics influence Klaus. I mean, I think Patience, it has like science fiction elements. In some ways, it's more of a study in contrast, though, than I would say David Boring is. I feel like when you look at David Boring, it's like, okay, you can really see sort of the beginning of someone looking at a superhero comic that has all these kind of crazy, outlandish ideas and interpolating a lot of emotional content into it. In Patience, it's sort of at the point where it kind of does what I think a lot of contemporary novels that have a certain kind of, you know, sci-fi or magical element do, which is they have one thing, like one element
that's different,
that's outlandish or fantastical, that motivates the plot along, moves the plot along, creates the opportunity for situations that wouldn't exist otherwise, and then beyond that is more about following through on the emotional consequences of those fantastic events, and also the and I think this is where it has something in common with the Superboy, the thematic resonance of the fantastic element. So, like, I mean, when you look at that Superboy comic, for example, and you see, you know, like Jor-El trapped in the Phantom Zone, or I think the comic ends with a panel of a bunch of like villains in the Phantom Zone, and
get tricked into going to it.
Yeah, and it's basically just like, oh, it's a bunch of ghosts who've been stuck in the Phantom Zone for years, standing around or like floating in the sky and bickering. And then it has like nice, neat cursive lettering, the end. And like, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you read something like that, it's not intended to, I don't think, have a great deal of emotional impact beyond its functioning as a basic plot element within this very odd sort of science fictional Superboy universe. But as a kid, that's the kind of thing that can have a lot of emotional resonance, because it's like, I mean, you can suddenly imagine, especially, I don't know, I mean, for me as a kid, like, I would always want to imagine, like, what if this stuff was real and stuff like that? And if you, you know, imagine, like, maybe, like, the world is full of, like, ghosts who are watching me, or imagine being trapped as a ghost in the Phantom Zone for thousands of years, and that would be kind of chilling. And with Klaus, I mean, what he's consciously doing is he is doing, you know, in Patience, he has this one fantastical element that has a lot of emotional resonance. And it's not, you know, I think there's a lot that he does with it that's very interesting. And, you know, it starts out, like Austin was explaining, with that, you know, sort of very direct motivation of like, oh, my wife was killed and I need to go back in time and stop it. But it actually, for the first part of the book especially, becomes a lot more about this, in a way, more interesting idea of being able to observe the life of someone who you have an intimate relationship with before you met them.
Right.
Which is a kind of interesting, really interesting thing. And I don't know that I've ever exactly seen it treated in that way before.
Oh, yeah. But what's interesting about that contrast is, as an adult reading this Superboy comic, the idea at the end with these characters in the Phantom Zone, as a kid, you're right, that would have really stayed with me and freaked me out, partly because it's drained of any the characters seeming like they're in pain. It almost becomes more creepy. But as an adult reading it, this comic is just pure fantasy. Like, I don't have to deal with – I guess that's what's appealing about it to me now. I can appreciate the work that went into it, but in terms of like it affecting me in any way, it's like you can just turn off the real world and enter into this comic because it's complete fantasy. But the Klaus comic really is – with the same concepts, as an adult, you need it to be explicitly about the real world to affect you. The class comic, especially the element of it that we're talking about, is kind of painful to read, or there's parts of it that are really affecting. And you know, it was hard to just read through without feeling pain for these characters. And I guess that's just a funny thing that happens as you know, in your life of reading comics. I think something that does, as a kid, something that doesn't play up the emotions can still be highly emotional.
Yeah.
But as you're older, if there's no characters crouching down at the end and screaming and no into space, it you know, it doesn't have any. It don't feel anything. I guess, I mean, the Superboy comic is just purely aesthetic to me, and the Klaus comic is it's like very real characters, you know, but they're both fantasy.
There's kind of an amusing aspect of the Superboy comic, just that you guys brought up, but I just sort of think is kind of funny that, like, actually for a very simple comic, it actually spends quite a lot of time, like, trying to figure out, like, what's moral about what to do with, like, bad people.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Because you say, like, it ends with this, what's actually quite disturbing, this image of, like, all the villains just stuck in the Phantom Zone standing around bickering. But, like, but this comic starts off with, like, the Kryptonian form of punishment is to just put people into a perpetual state of suspended animation and they just orbit the planet forever.
Right.
And Jor-El has invented this more humane means of, you know, of dealing with villains, which is to put them in the Phantom Zone. But there's also this weird little sequence where, like, he's the executioner of Krypton.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about that.
Yeah. It's almost like this is where, like, superhero parody comes from, you know, because, like, there's this, I mean, it's not enough that Jor-El has to be the inventor of the Phantom Zone, but, you know, and has to, like, compete in these weird reality shows to get, you know, people to, like, approve his inventions. But then you also find out, oh, by the way, Jor-El is also the head executioner of Krypton.
Yeah. And he feels
this, like, Batman, like, you know, executioner's mask, and, you know, they're sending the criminal into suspended animation because the Phantom Zone hasn't been approved yet, and the criminal, like, before they, like, gas him, is like, oh, whatever happened to Jor-El's great new invention that he was working on? I thought he was inventing a less cruel method of punishment. And the executioner, who was, of course, actually Jor-El, is like, I'm sure Jor-El is working on it night and day. And he's thinking, how I hate this job.
You know, what's crazy is,
but, like, that's what disturbed me as a kid, because, like, they establish that this guy has a family, he's not actually bad. Like, he's still getting, you know, but, like, the law is the law. And also, just real quick, on the panel 4, where the guy is, like, saying, I will, you know, like, he's basically pleading. Like, that is a face that looks like a Dan Klaus drawing to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
Yeah, like, this. Anyway, go ahead, what you were going to say, Austin.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's funny, though, because really there is just one. While the Superboy comic is just loaded with all these sci-fi elements, it hinges on this one silly idea, how we can't send our criminals into orbit anymore. How do we fix that? That's the one idea that puts all these other crazy ideas into motion. What was I going to say? I don't know. I mean, the Klaus just sticks to you. One concept that's different. This guy's traveling back in time and hones in on the emotions. Where I guess that's what's crazy about DC. They have one little thing goes wrong. There's one little blip, and you see this now with how they manage their relaunches and everything. They spend so much effort explaining one thing while kind of ignoring the emotional logic of it. They just go deeper and deeper into, you know, the blips and errors that one idea causes.
Yeah. I was reading the letters pages in this comic, and somebody writes in about
letters pages.
Smallville mail sack.
Yes, Smallville mail sack. And somebody writes in, goes, if Superboy's costume was made of the indestructible blankets with which he was covered when he was projected to Earth, how were his foster parents, the Kents, able to cut the invulnerable blankets into a costume? And they say that This was reported in great detail in an untold story published many years ago. To give you a brief synopsis, the Kents unraveled the threads of the blankets and rewove them to form parts of his costume. And then Superboy cut the threads using his heat vision. But it's like, yes, like, this is 1964. It's been over 50 years of trying to, like, every little detail, we're going to try and make it so it actually sort of, you know, like, works in some way. Like, you know, like, everything's, like, justified.
Yeah. Well, that shows you the two responses to this type of material. You know, the one is, you know, just trying to work out the logic of something that wasn't really built to withstand that kind of investigation. And the other is the Clausian approach, which is to kind of invest in the emotional logic and then move outward from there. It's like with Patience, for example, I've only really read it all the way through once. I kind of, last week when it first came out, I kind of skimmed parts of it this morning just so it wouldn't be totally like in the back of my mind when we were talking. And, you know, I think there is stuff that, you know, you can puzzle out in terms of like the mechanics of the time travel and so on, but obviously they're like irrelevant, you know, to the primary experience of reading the book, I think. It seems like it couldn't be less important to Klaus to explain to you, the reader, how this time travel device works or what the limitations of it are. It's like the device itself is as much of a kind of loose bit of cartooning as the masterful drawing on those pages.
Yeah. Totally. And I also like that in these projects that like David Boring and Death Ray and Patience that are so clearly influenced by this era of cartooning, Klaus is not in any, even though he's a humorist, he's not parodying these artists in any way. He's responding to them, and I think in a way, this era of comics, so many people poke fun of it, but I think Klaus silently kind of, without calling attention to it, really just is working in the tradition of it and not criticizing it, which I think is, I think is really interesting.
Well, he's kind of honoring the level of investment that this kind of material might inspire in a younger reader who encounters it on its own terms, and then bringing that forward into an adult form of expression, which is actually the appropriate response to the material. It's not to, you know, make Superman a more like adult sexy character or something like that. You know, it's to sort of take that initial inspiration and then bring it forward into new kinds of stories.
Maybe this is a good moment to sort of segue into the other book a little bit, because you mentioned sort of this idea of like, you know, like concepts that like, you know, is this book sort of is built around a concept that's sort of a bit like out of, you know, that's a strange concept that sort of, you know, isn't really like explained or, you know, it isn't really important that you understand what's happening, like the reason. So what do you want to explain what the other book is?
So the other book is Peplum by Blutch, who's a French cartoonist. Blutch has produced a bunch of books in France. I think for a while in the U.S., probably the work of his that most people had seen were issues of Mitchum, which weren't really distributed here, but I think it was just a kind of thing that people like would go and go to France and bring back as gifts.
I'm going to grab my copy of Mitchum.
Okay.
So we just have it here.
People would bring issues of Mitchum back as gifts for other cartoonists. I think there might have been some very minor distribution. I bought a few copies from Cornelius once myself and, you know, sold them to people. Because, you know, the nice thing about Mitchum is it's beautiful drawing. People go crazy for it. And Mitchum is, a lot of it is wordless. So there are these comics that, and it almost seems like the kind of comics a super, super, super masterful artist would just come up with in their sketchbook as a form of play.
Okay.
Anyway, but he's produced a bunch of books. His first book in English came out, I guess now, maybe a year and a half ago or so, right before Picture Box closed down. They published So Long, Silver Screen, a book by Blutch about cinema, essentially his reflections on cinema. So that was the first proper book by Blutch to be published in English. And then just now, New York Review Comics, which is the new comics imprint of New York Review of Books, has published Peplum, which is a book that at this point, I don't remember the exact French publication date, but it's probably, you know, about 15 years old or something.
I think instead of the late 90s, it started being serialized.
So this was a book that was serialized and was published in a collected edition by Cornelius, now it's been published in English by New York Review Comics. It's part of the first wave of releases from the comics imprint of New York Review of Books, and it becomes the second Blutch book published in English.
And I mean, maybe to say right off the bat, what a great first choice for any publishing imprint to start out with. I just thought it was, the only Blutch I had before was Mitchum, and I had a sense that I loved Blutch's cartooning, but I didn't understand it at all in the same way that I did after reading Peplum, because his there should be more translated work by master cartoonists like Blutch, because his writing and storytelling, reading Mitchum, I was like, this guy's a master. I love looking at this. It makes me want to draw. It's a completely different way of cartooning. But reading Peplum, I was like, this guy is 100 times better than I thought. It's just the control of storytelling. It has the same level of storytelling as that airtight Superboy comic, combined with these really bold, expressive. You know, Mitchum, was incredibly experimental, and this too has these just touches that are more painterly than normal cartooning, but it still functions as amazing tight cartooning. Maybe Pfeiffer is an example where it's someone that is an expert storyteller. Everything communicates, but it's very free in its line. And this was this is one of the best examples of those two things coming together that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. It's really incredible because maybe this is kind of a legacy of like coming from getting into comics, particularly independent comics, at a time where there was like more of a kind of bifurcation between a real explicit, maybe even antagonism between so-called mainstream comics and independent comics. But I don't really think of myself as someone who responds to chops. You know, like, right. Oh, that artist's got chops. He can draw a lot of anything. But it's like with Blutch, it's like, wow, this guy really, he can draw anything. And like the anatomy, it's like, even, it's exaggerated and it's loose, but you do not draw figures in movement like that unless like you can really draw figures. Like, I mean, I don't know if he's – I've met Blutch a couple of times in France just very casually. I don't really know a lot about his background. I don't know if he's just kind of like a prodigy or if he's done, like thousands of hours of life drawing or what. But his drawing is so informed, and yet there's never on the one hand, he's never he's never fussy. For as much realism as is in the drawing sometimes, it's never fussy or preoccupied with showing off like how perfectly he can draw like, a muscle or a figure or something like that. On the other hand, what it also doesn't have is it doesn't, in its looseness, it doesn't – what's weird about it is his style is so him, and yet it's never mannered. There's never a precious thing about it of like, well, I draw noses like this or something like that, which you see in a there are other artists who, have chops, quote unquote chops, and then they infuse it with a kind of looseness. But then there's this sort of overbearing, preening stylization where it's like, well, my characters all have this haircut, or something, or like whatever. I mean, I don't want to name names, but
You can.
Yeah, but in In Blutch, it just hits this kind of perfect point where it's like the drawing's informed. It's grounded exactly in the ways that it needs you to be to convince you of the reality of the world and the true sensuousness of all of the forms in it, not just the human forms, but whether it's a human form or a tree or whatever he's drawing. He gives you the realism is all there to communicate something about it. And then it stops, and then it gets cartoony and expressive, but again, never crossing the line into mannerism.
And it doesn't, when it makes those transitions, it doesn't miss a beat. I think it might be because he has all this skill, but the thing that he's most concerned with is storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I think this comic does something that I've seen everyone try to do, and I've never seen it done so well, where the story will be the characters will be a little bit simplified, and then we'll hit a moment where he decided to draw the detail. It won't even be like a splash page or anything. It'll be like a panel in the middle of a page where he put a lot more detail in it to make you notice a certain detail more, and then it'll go back to slightly more simplified. And I've never been reading a comic where someone tries to do that. I even when it's not done well, I kind of enjoy when people do that. But with this, I read that detailed panel with the same speed as the simplified images, and I understand that he's calling attention to a certain aspect of the story, and then I immediately process that in richer emotional drawing and then go back into the simplified panels without missing a beat. And I was just, when I noticed that happening, I was just so impressed. And it's really pleasurable to it's something where the storytelling is so well done and the drawing is so beautiful and you're so immersed in the story. And you just, as you're reading it, you enjoy it so much, and you experience the story he's telling. And it's kind of, in terms of how it makes you feel, it's in between Superboy and Patience, where it references real world emotions. There's painful things that happen in it, but it's not melodramatic. It's like a pure old time comic with modern art comic elements to it, but it's kind of just this perfect balance between the two. It's kind of I don't know. It's kind of what you would wish serious comics could be that still had some kind of dialogue with more carefree comics.
So as someone who draws, like the effect this sort of drawing always has on me is that you read it and it has a look about it like it wasn't that hard, like it was done quickly, and like he did it quick, and you're like, oh, I should do like this, but like it's super deceptive because like it's extremely well skilled. He obviously, I feel like I should mention, like to me, I saw Blutch, I saw some of his work at Angoulême once, but I've never really read any of his comics before. But you could definitely see how Craig Thompson is obviously probably big, largely influenced by him. I guess it would go that way around, right?
I was thinking that when I read Peplum, because actually
sitting, I think Thompson gives a quote on the back of the book.
Yes, yeah, there's a Craig Thompson quote on the back. Looking at Mitchum and just seeing the drawings and trying to get into it, without reading the part that has dialogue on the back that's in French. I didn't get the Thompson connection as much, but with Peplum, which has more traditional comic book page layouts, I really, really, I thought about Craig Thompson in it so much. I mean, it's
made me think of Habibi a lot.
Oh yeah, but less brushy though.
Thompson, I think, especially, I mean, from Blankets onward, you see very much that he's someone who was kind of an early, maybe aware earlier than many other Americans of some of the French artists like Edmond Baudouin, Blutch, and David Bay, and is bringing some of that influence into his comics. But the big difference, I guess, between Blutch and Thompson is that, Thompson has a real tightness to all of the work. I mean, there's a place for the kind of expressive brushiness to come in, but everything in Thompson's work feels very thoroughly worked out. Every page feels very thoroughly designed. There's a kind of mannerist, decorative type of sensibility to it. I think there's also a kind of Will Eisner influence that you don't see in Blutch, where he's trying to design the whole page so that there's a literal design under every page to guide you through it. Whereas with Blutch, it feels a bit, even though there are some panels that really do have a lot of concrete detail in them, it feels like he never... even though he's very skilled, it feels like he never quite gets that tight, and there's kind of a freedom and looseness, a feeling of freedom and looseness that just lasts from the first page to the very end, and that works with the propulsive feeling of the plot and the feeling too of like anything can happen and the sort of elliptical tone of the narrative and the mood.
Well, I wonder. If Blutch is so tight that there's a level of improvisation going on in how he draws some of these pages, and I don't know how Thompson works, but I would imagine that Thompson does a lot of penciling out and breakdowns and everything. I can only imagine how much preparation goes into his comics because they're so expertly done. And I'm wondering, with some of these Blutch panels, is he so skillful that he sat down and had an idea of what was going to happen on this page and just did it without that much prep? Mm-hmm. I mean, someone who's more of a Blutch expert, I'd love to know, but there's something about it that if he does break it down and pencil it out and – it still feels so alive. I'd be impressed either way if he sat down and just did it all in ink, or if he had preparation going in. The result is equally amazing, but I really can't say it looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, you can only speculate. I mean, one thing this has in common with Patience is that both of those books are about a character, a male character, who throughout the book is like hyper-focused on an idealized image of a woman. And, you know, in Patience, you know, it's this character who, you know, he's married and he's gonna, you know, about to have a baby with his you know, young wife. He's a young guy. And then, you know, very quickly she's murdered. And he spends this whole book, you know, moving through a lot of experiences trying to hyper-focused on trying to fix this and get things sort of hit the reset button on this whole situation, even though many years and exotic adventures pass by. And similarly, I mean, Peplum by Blutch is almost like a literalization of that metaphor or something, where it's literally a character who has a frozen woman who he is obsessed with, who he's separated from, reunited with, and his obsession with this kind of frozen woman sort of distorts his interactions sometimes with real live people and his assessment of opportunities or evaluations of, you know, real flesh and blood relationships that he has with other people in the story.
But I guess the difference between this character and the character in Patience, the character in Peplum, whose name we don't know because he steals someone else's name, he doesn't seem that pained about this obsession. I mean, that's why Peplum is kind of just like, on one level, just an adventure comic. He's kind of just stumbling through the story, badly affecting almost everyone else in it. But he, for lack of a better phrase, he does it with a smile on his face, whereas Klaus's characters are always telling you that they have a smile on their face. Like, I always – like, the key for me with understanding Klaus's later work is the character in The Death Ray, who's always like, yeah, you know, I'm just basically a nice guy. I don't ever – you know, he's like zapping people away. And it's like that in Patience too. It's always like, you know, I'll do anything to pay this money back, or the guy who makes the time travel device, he's like, I'm so grateful to him. You know, I'm going to pay him back. And, you know, he's doing the exact opposite you know, he's telling you with a straight face all the good things he's going to do, but you see his actions being like, so like deeply neurotic and pain, and every panel just like seething with, watching his wife in the past before he knew her from behind, in a closet. It's just like, the exact opposite of this carefree narrative voice. Whereas in Peplum, I think the character is kind of, maybe I should read it again and prove myself wrong, but he seems like he's enjoying himself throughout most of the thing. And in the end, after
enjoying himself, exactly.
Well, yeah, he gets
goes through
tortured,
a lot of torments,
yeah,
and things like that.
Yeah,
too.
But look, but in the end, he's like,
in the end,
quickly after going through that torment, he's he's seems pretty happy.
Yeah. Well, it's almost. I think it's more just kind of like a grim acceptance of the ultimate sort of brutality of life, from the very beginning, it begins with a sort of parodic version of the murder of Julius Caesar, from, like Shakespeare. And, it's clearly this kind of caricature of high flown language. So you have this society that at the top of its hierarchy has, on the one hand, this sort of high-flown self-regard, but even at that stratum, it's ultimately governed by, the kind of law of the jungle, and it's just all about which side has the most muscle and the most knives and so on. It's political power that's seized by force.
Yeah.
And then from there, it just trickles down. You've got this hierarchical society that's sort of posited right from the beginning, but then within it, just at every level, everyone's kind of at constant risk of just being an utter victim. At the same time, that there's also this kind of all this weird sort of otherworldly cultural stuff swirling around. The introduction by the translator, they quote at length some things that Blutch had to say, and he basically, he said that one of the attractions to him about writing about something like ancient Rome, the ancient world of Western Europe, is that, it really feels like, it might as well be Mars. It's just a completely alien place. There, it says that in part the book is a response to the Satyricon by Petronius, which was also sort of the inspiration for Fellini's film Satyricon, which I haven't seen in many years, but reading this book actually made me want to watch Fellini's Satyricon again, because I don't feel like it necessarily has the same events in it very much, but it did have that same kind of mood of a sort of, kind of loose focus on a central character episodically moving from scene to scene in this ancient landscape with sometimes violent, sometimes surreal things happening. But to go back to what I was saying, just this idea that these characters' motivations are so alien to us that they might as well be like UFOs. But at the heart of it is a kind of brutality, this idea that anyone could be seized or killed or made a slave or taken hostage or destroyed, or made a king, at any moment. And so it just ends with this kind of like grim acceptance of the absurdity of the world.
I think we're sort of towards the end. Do you guys have other things you wanted to sort of mention?
I guess one thing that I'll say one thing before we stop talking about Peplum, but I was like looking at the beginning of the book when you were talking about the mock Julius Caesar part, and the way Blutch moves his characters on the page, what I always responded to in Eisner, in his non-spirit work, was the way the movement of the characters, which I always thought was the thing that I, the one thing in Eisner, in the serious Eisner, that I really, really thought was worth the praise it gets. Mm-hmm. And the way Blutch almost blows even that great aspect of Eisner for me away. Just the way this scene, where Julius Caesar is assassinated, it's just so the acting is so lively and so beautiful to watch. And I just, you know, it, if anything is an artistic one up or criticism of even the best of Eisner, I think this book, you know, maybe Blutch loves Eisner, but I just think this kind of wipes away what I thought was essential about Eisner's serious work.
Yeah, I did think of Eisner a little bit when I was looking at this. There's particularly one sequence, I wonder if I can find it now, where two characters are fighting. And this is when the main character steals the gold and then acquires the so-called little brother who he takes with him on his journey. And there's a sequence where they're fighting.
Yeah.
And it's just two people. You know, it almost looks like a series of like wrestling moves on page 63. And that was that sequence especially reminded me exactly of Eisner, where often like the background will almost drop out and you'll just have these figures moving. And so that to me kind of felt like Blutch sort of nodding to the Eisner way of doing it in a way that's very appropriate, because it is two figures just fighting each other. But what he does often the rest of the time is he keeps that sense of the figure. He keeps that sense of fluidity. He keeps that sense of movement from image to image. But unlike Eisner, he doesn't feel the need to stick with this proscenium-like theatrical point of view. And he's perfectly happy to kind of, you know, even very slightly change the point of view or change the cropping or whatever, because each one makes a better picture
that
way.
He's not like, this is my thing. I phrase things theatrically and I'm going to stick to that and just pound you over the head with how well I do this, which is maybe sometimes what I get from Eisner. Blutch, I think it seems like he enjoys doing this more, and he uses it when it's – well, it's not like he's zeroing in on that when it's exactly the right – you know, it's just more he mixes it up, and it's just he doesn't overdo it. He doesn't – I guess he does all this – this book is full of amazing things like that, but he's never – alerting you to how amazing each little device is. They work in the whole fabric of the thing.
Yeah, I think on, like, on page 10 for me, like this is in the middle of the scene, which is like the assassination of Caesar. Like Caesar's talking on the first panel, the three like large wide panels. And on the third one, it's just like heavily shadowed. It's just like this reverse shot. And like, I think this is sort of what you're getting at. Like, it doesn't exactly sort of flow, but it looks awesome. Like, it just doesn't really.
Like that face in shadows is almost like a Gary Panter drawing.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, it's like it got real like brushy, like it got very sort of, like thick and brushy and dry brush, and I just love looking at that one panel. But it's sort of like it's jumping kind of like into a different style, like there.
Yeah, or almost like leaning towards like Stefano Ricci or something.
But it doesn't break the strength of the storytelling. I mean, I'm noticing that element now as being off from the rest of the page. But when I was reading it, I think I just read it as Caesar is there kind of removed from the person he's talking to. You know, I read it as information, even though it's so highly expressive.
Yeah. Well, it's an opportunity to draw attention to more a different kind of detail of what that character is intended to look like. But rather than going in with like a real fine line and etching in like every little wrinkle that would be distracting and remove from the focus, which is the speaker, he lays in with the brush.
Yeah.
So you read it, you can actually read it very quickly as like, oh, this character is like super kind of haggard and wrinkled.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot, and it impresses you with by suggesting a lot of detail. That's like a Milt Caniff kind of moment, but way more expressive than Caniff ever would have been. One thing I wanted to mention too is that in totally different ways, I think Clowes in Patience and Blutch in Peplum really find an incredible balance between tightness and looseness in their drawing. I think one thing that people are probably not likely to comment on adequately is where Clowes's drawing is at in patience, because there's very little vocabulary in much writing about comics that sort of even begins to get at the kind of stuff that Klaus is doing. I think there's going to be a lot of emphasis on like, oh, it's like more detailed than the last few books, and there's all these like psychedelic freakout pages. It's like, you know, I find it very understandable, but a little disingenuous in a way that like a lot of the images from patients that keep getting blasted out are these sort of handful of psychedelic Steve Ditko looking pages. And there are some of them in the book, but it's hardly the dominant aesthetic. It's not like Klaus decided he was going to do his paper rad epic finally or something like that.
I mean, it's less than 1% of the book that's like that.
And, but what you see is that, you know, especially if you compare this to something like David Boring, it's like, it's in, you know, when you just look at something like David Boring, or even some of the sequences in Ice Haven, you know, he is capable of really tight drawing. Yeah. And in some of his more recent books, particularly Wilson, he's kind of moved towards a sort of looser, almost more Charles Schulz-like kind of style at times. Here he's returning to a project that has a demand for a certain kind of consistent concrete realism all the way through. But what he manages to do is really approximate that realism. And it's almost, if you stop and look at individual panels, it's almost incredible how approximate some of the, you know, images in this, you know, so-called realistic looking book are. I mean, I'm looking at one page. I know you don't have the book in front of you, Mike, but on page 20.
I don't have patience.
What we're looking at randomly, it's like, if you look at the shoes in the last panel, I mean, they just look like he just like whipped it out in a second. It's just like an approximation of what the shape of a foot looks like. And it's almost like he's drawing around. He knows what the actual form is, and he's just sort of drawing around it with his brush or something like that. So, and that's the way that Klaus sort of balances tightness and looseness, you know, to kind of be a sort of loose and lively cartoonist. And Bletch, of course, does it in a different way that I think we covered pretty well. And of course, one big difference is with Klaus, it's a little bit more like that DC Comics style, where there's a lot going on, but there's kind of a juxtaposition of images that can have a lot of contrast and stillness, but still move the story along. Whereas in the Bletch, it's definitely about really the images and the figures often moving the story along.
Right. I feel like after David Boring, this is just a guess, but I just, the way Klaus's art to me changed after David Boring, I bet he started drawing with his arm. And it's with this project that he's Ice Haven looks great, but it's so much looser than David Boring. And I feel like now, if my theory is correct that he started drawing with his arm after David Boring, I feel like now he he's settled into it to the
point.
What do
you mean drawing with his arm? Like, you mean like just a larger sort of?
It just, like, that's, I've always, listen, I mean, the way I draw, I have no idea of how you're supposed to do it correctly, but I've always read that you have more, if you're a master draftsman, you have more control over what you're doing if you draw with your arm rather than with your hand. Like, you move your arm to make the lines rather than moving your hand. And I feel like it's supposed to add a more assurance to the line and more openness, and it's supposed to be less like, you know, needling and labored. And I feel like David Boring is where he got it, you know. David Boring is so tight, and I feel like Ice Haven things really opened up. And I've just always wondered if he changed maybe he changed tools, but I feel like it just the shapes open up in Ice Haven, and I feel like from what little I've read about drawing with your arm, that it feels like it lines up with that. And it feels like with Patience, since his style has opened up, it's almost this ratio now between the high tightness of David Boring to the style he's working in now. I mean, am I crazy? Does it seem like after David Boring, his style opened up that way?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I never thought about it so much in terms of changing a technique or anything like that. But I did kind of feel like with David Boring, both in terms of wanting to make a classically structured novelistic story and in terms of drawing in a certain meticulously detailed way, he kind of reached a certain level with David Boring, where I think he probably took it as far as he wanted to take it. You know, I think he took that like tight, excruciatingly rendered drawing where he, you know, he's trying to get the little fold in the elbow of the shirt to look exactly perfect the way Wayne Boring or someone would do it. I think he took that as far as it could go. And I think at that point, he then wanted to do something else. And that's certainly part of what Icehaven is about, is branching out into other stylistic areas, because I think he went as far as he could go and as far as he wanted to go and as far as he needed to go in terms of making a graphic novel that had as much sort of detail, dramatic realism, you know, with fine rendering and accuracy with patience. It kind of feels like he's returned to a type of story that one could imagine drawn more in the way that David Boring is drawn. But having gone through that prism of loosening up and trying all different styles, he now brings a real cartoonist's looseness to the rendering of mostly realistic elements within a dramatic narrative that has a consistency over many pages.
We on a previous episode of the show, we talked about the Death Ray, and it led to an argument where I'm pretty sure I saw a photo of Dan Clowes with like a gigantic novelty sized drawing board, and that sort of sounds like what Austin's talking about. He uses his whole arm. He has this like humongous drawing board. But I think Jim Rugg and Caitlin McGurk disagreed.
Well, I'm glad to unconsciously confirm that that maybe you are correct.
Yes, he works on a giant-sized novelty drawing board. He looks like a 7-year-old sitting at it.
Mr. Price.
I heard he also draws with a giant novelty pencil.
I think that's true as well. That's how he gets that looseness in his arm.
There he is. Hey, buddy, how was your weekend? Your mind was too short. Hey,